Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. We made it! Thanks to your support, we've funded a full year's worth of recording and production of Let It Roll. Today, Nate and Ed Legg continue their discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year, with a look at the glam metal scene on LA's Sunset Strip. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. Or should I say 80s roll? That's right. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, welcoming back Ed Legg to continue our discussion of Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year by Michelangelo Matos. Ed, welcome back. Are you ready for some hair metal?
Darn right I am.
All right. And so last week we talked about the second British invasion, Culture Club, Duran Duran, Eurythmics, Human League, et cetera, et cetera. This week, we're talking about another big factor that was going on, which was the pop metal explosion. Spearheaded by Van Halen, who had been going strong since 1978 for Warner Brothers, followed up by Ozzy Osbourne, who had poached the second best guitarist on the LA Sunset Strip scene. Randy Rhoads was second to no one. He was every bit Eddie Van Halen's peer in many ways, but he had been playing with a group called Quiet Riot. Ozzy found him and hired him away. Quiet Riot manages to hit big. Motley Crue comes along in 81, 82 in the wake of Van Halen. And then Def Leppard, of course, comes over from the New Wave, the new wave of British heavy metal scene, and makes a big impact. But let's talk about the chapter. Let's talk first impressions, because it's like this stuff, these lines were not drawn as clearly as they are drawn now, is what I want to, you know, a lot of times people in the 2020s, those who think about heavy metal at all, define heavy metal as, you know, Black Sabbath and then Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, Metallica, and anything that's not in that strict tradition is not metal. So Van Halen is not metal. Def Leppard is not metal. That is not the case in 1984. In 1984, Van Halen was definitively heavy metal until they put out Jump. Do you remember when you first heard Jump, or were you the whole synthesizer thing, and were you surprised by that?
I was underwhelmed by it. I remember I was driving from Alabama to Georgia across the state line, and I'm sure that had something to do with it. And it was probably about 11 o'clock on a Saturday night when I heard it. And it was certainly a change.
Yes. Yes, it was a change. And I think for me, my little crew of friends who, you know, Van Halen was definitely the biggest thing in sixth grade, which was 1980, 81. And you know, loved the first couple of Van Halens. We loved Women and Children First. We loved Fair Warning. And then Diver Down was the one that in my crew, hit like a big stink bomb and bummed everybody out. So that I had kind of already written Van Halen off when Jump came out. And so I was just pleasantly surprised that it was a cool pop song. And then when Panama, et cetera, came out, I was like, okay, well, this, you know, and I can't remember if I actually bought the tape or not, but I definitely heard the whole thing, whether I bought it or not. You know, massively effective. But let's talk about Matos and how he tells the story. He actually starts with Tom Werman, who was a metal producer. He had produced, he was with Epic, and he had signed Ted Nugent. He had signed Cheap Trick, produced one of Cheap Trick's albums. And he's somebody, you know, he talks about this in the chapter where Dee Snider of Twisted Sister had trashed his production techniques on Twisted Sister's big hit breakout album. And I can tell you for a fact, I mean, Cheap Trick in Color, it's just an atrocity. It's got I Want You to Want Me, and it does not, you know, like you hear the live version, that the hit single we all know and love, and then you hear the version that was officially recorded in the studio, and you're just like, what is going on? But nonetheless, this cat was super talented and made a whole bunch of hits and produced Motley Crue also. And the thing I want to get to, though, is this perception, I think, through this whole period from 78 to 84 had been that, I mean, the perception definitely in 77 was that metal was dead and punk and new wave were these new things that are going to take over. Van Halen bucked that. I mean, I was looking at their sales charts. First album sold 10 million copies. I probably only sold 5 or 6 million in the first few years, but still massive hit. Second album does about half that. And then by the third, fourth album, they're down to 1 million copies each. Diver Down actually reversed the trend, and then Jump with the number one hit single is absolutely massive and gets them all the way back to the to their you know, 10 million diamond level sales, but at a cost. They're no longer America's leading heavy metal band, and in fact fell apart shortly thereafter with David Lee Roth leaving and Sammy Hagar joining the new Van Halen, which many derisively call Van Hagar. But nobody else got signed. Quiet Riot could not get signed to a major label, despite being right behind Van Halen and having Randy Rhoads on guitar. And it was only because, you know, Ozzy Osbourne had a deal and he brings Randy Rhoads along. And it's not until, you know, Motley Crue releases their first album independently and it's doing so strong that the labels jump in and get into metal. I mean, what I'm trying to get at is nobody believed that heavy metal was going to be what it was in the 80s, which was hands down the dominant form of rock and roll in multiple genres. Did you see metal coming at this point, or had you written metal off? I mean, what was your take?
Well, this is when I start really feeling my age and my bias, because I actually love In Color, and actually he did
nothing wrong with that.
Werman produced, actually he did produce the next album too, which was Heaven Tonight, and yep. But he had nothing to do with the live album, and they definitely were mad at him about the way In Color sounded, and it does sound plastic for sure. But the Van Halen part of the equation, I was basically from my senior year in high school until my senior year in college, every spring they released an album and every summer toured. And I saw the 78 tour when they opened for Journey and Montrose. And I missed them in 79, which was a theater, small theater tour. But then I saw them in their first arena tour in 80 and then 81. And, you know, each time they're getting bigger. And they are starting to lose the plot. I mean, it is interesting. I did not realize that it was that big a drop off, but they were so potent when they first came out. Nobody, in fact, one of your colleagues in the podcast network, Martin Popoff, says that Van Halen, well, they were so hot when they came in that they were mopping the floor with everybody they opened for. And, yeah. You know, they were just so so potent and such a, I mean, great rhythm section, really strong front man, unbelievable guitar player. And when I saw them in the arena, the two arena shows, they were already getting lazy, and it was much more spectacle and bombast. And it was like they were getting bored. I think they were better when they were hungry, like, you know, like most
like everybody
fans.
Else. Yeah, yeah. Let's go ahead and hear a little bit. This is Panama off of 1984 by Van Halen. And that was Panama by Van Halen. I resisted the temptation to play Jump because I think everybody's probably heard it. If not, you can go find it easily. The thing about Jump, though, is it's pretty much the same move that Asia and the Police and ZZ Top had made, where they took 70s style sounds, added keyboards and drum machines, and kind of 80s it up. But the thing was about Van Halen, Eddie was using new kinds of amplification and new guitar technology, and actually managed to give electric guitar a second life. And so, you know, they could do tracks like The Kinks, You Really Got Me, and it sounded like a whole new song. It was a whole new sound. It clearly sounded like an update of it. And it was just really ferocious. And that's why an album like Diver Down, which me and my friends were kind of down on because it had so many covers, Oh Pretty Woman and Dance in the Street, we were kind of scratching our heads. But commercially, it worked brilliantly because those songs are great songs. And Van Halen was able to update the sound. And then, you know, Matos gets into this big into the big debate that happened around the US Festival. US Festival 1983 is when the business finally had to admit that metal was going to be a big part of the 80s, because Steve Wozniak, one of the co-founders of Apple with Steve Jobs, was funding this festival. He funded it, I think, in 82 and then again in 83. And in 83, Van Halen headlined the Metal Day, which drew 330,000. New Wave, and that was a Sunday night. New Wave Day, I believe, was Saturday, and that was headlined by The Clash. David Bowie headlined Rock Day. And remember, David Bowie is hot off Let's Dance at this point. He'd just been on the cover of Time magazine. But those two nights only did around 400,000 combined. So, you know, more people, almost as many people showed up for Metal Day as Rock and New Wave combined. And I remember this at the time vividly. The Van Halen guys absolutely trashed The Clash, you know, calling them three chord wonders, talking trash about them on stage, talking trash about them in interviews. And in my middle school, I was one of the only kids who liked The Clash at all. And I was taking guitar lessons from this a guy in my hometown, and his son was a friend of mine and played guitar too. And he was very much on the Van Halen side. I wasn't full-throated on the Clash side, but I thought the Clash was good, and I didn't really understand, what do you mean they can't play? This sounds like people who can play to me. And so we took his dad and my guitar teacher noticed the argument, and he was a country music guy, and he asked us to bring in our tapes so he could check it out. And he came back with, well, it's all that loud rock and roll crap I can't stand, and neither band has a good singer, although they both have good background singers. And that one band has a heck of a lead guitarist. But kids, I got to tell you, that band plays in 4/4 time in every song. And the other band can actually change time signatures, which is actually the hardest thing to do if you're in a band. And so I was pretty pleased by that. And you know, Van Halen did have a good rhythm section, but they also had a pretty unimaginative rhythm section. Michael Anthony sang great background vocals, but was a pretty lazy bass player who tended to just boom, 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 boom on one note. So, you know, anyway, but that was the debate. It was very much this backlash of real red-blooded rock and roll against all this new wave, and insert your homophobic slur of choice there, because they certainly did in the 80s. And Van Halen managed to update the metal thing. They had spandex instead of denim, which, you know, and he mentions this in the chapter, in the late 70s, the uniform at a Ted Nugent show or the Texas Jam or something like that was all denim, blue jeans and jeans jackets all the way. And Van Halen updated that with spandex and just had a dramatically different look. And because of Eddie Van Halen's sound, they had a dramatically different sound, and they updated the formula and thoroughly proved that rock and roll still had an enormous amount of life. And then Eddie Van Halen with his tapping, to me, was kind of the apotheosis of what Louis Armstrong had started in the 20s by introducing virtuoso soloists into American popular music, which is a big deal and not something that had existed before Louis Armstrong. And you have generation after generation through people like Gene Krupa and Charlie Parker and, you know, John Coltrane and Jimi Hendrix, who Michael Bloomfield, this idea of virtuosity was incredibly appealing to people. And I think Eddie Van Halen was kind of the last guy to do it and really blow people away and really impress people, because his imitators over the next 10 years absolutely ran that into the ground. They ran the entire virtuoso thing into the ground. But now we got to cover some more ground. So let's talk Quiet Riot. Do you remember when Quiet Riot had the number one album in the land?
Absolutely. And, you know, it is interesting to me how many times Quiet Riot has come up on the podcast that I listen to, which yours is one. Martin Popoff's is one, and that's more metal oriented. But it kind of amazes me how they broke through. And when I think of Friday Night Videos, I think of that video for Quiet Riot's Come On, Feel the Noise.
Yep, absolutely. It was a massive, massive hit. And I think it was the combination. They had the icon, they had the figure with the hockey mask, which was, I'm not sure
yes.
if their hockey mask guy was before Jason of Friday the 13th or not, but it was.
He was after it, but it was far enough. It had not become a cliche yet, so it still was effective and kind of scary.
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted.
No, not at all. And the other thing they did, you know, they had lost the great Randy Rhoads, which,
yeah,
that's a big blow. And, you know, Ozzy's comeback has built two great albums with Randy Rhoads, Blizzard of Oz and Diary of a Madman, before Randy Rhoads is tragically killed in a totally avoidable and stupid flying accident in Florida while they were on tour, flying in a small plane, buzzing the bus. Do not buzz the tour bus, you know, especially not with a superstar guitar player in the small private plane. But Quiet Riot got big because their producer talked them into, Spencer Proffer talked them into covering Slade. And essentially, Slade was one of several glam bands in England in the early 70s who never made a dent in the States, or maybe a dent, but not much more than that. So you have this whole catalog of hit songs waiting to be introduced to the American audience. And that's what Quiet Riot did, was updated Slade. And it was just a hit formula waiting to happen. And one thing that's interesting, he talks about this in Def Leppard, with Def Leppard too, is that this generation of bands was very aware of punk. They might have disavowed punk or wanted to disassociate themselves from punk, but they were influenced by punk. And a band like Def Leppard, they were in Britain for the glam period. They were direct descendants of Slade and Sweet and Mudd and T-Rex and Bowie and that whole wave. But there was the quote. Did you notice the quote from Mutt Lange, of all people, who the super slick producer who had, you know, made AC/DC superstars, did the same thing for Def Leppard. But he said his vision for Def Leppard was great pop songs that resonate with the punk ethos. Do you see much punk ethos in Def Leppard? Where's the punk ethos?
I certainly didn't at the time. And I didn't, you know, it's a great question. I mean, maybe it's the energy or just the, you know, the everyman approach. But, I saw it as hard, as really tasty, hard, hook laden, tasty, hard rock in a way that I didn't feel about Bon Jovi. And I'm still trying to figure that out.
We'll talk about Bon Jovi before
the
end of the show. But let's go ahead. Let's go ahead and hear a little bit of Randy Rhoads and Ozzy Osbourne. This is Over the Mountain. Oh, And that was Ozzy Osbourne featuring Randy Rhoads with Over the Mountain, one of his from his solo comeback in the early 80s. And to me, Van Halen and Ozzy with Randy Rhoads were the two spearheads of this new wave of LA metal. And then Quiet Riot comes along and cleverly incorporates Slade, which is the same sort of secret ingredient of the British stuff, which Def Leppard was an exponent of, what they call the new wave of British heavy metal, which is more, you tend to classically think of Iron Maiden as being the definitive Nawabum band, but Def Leppard was definitely one of those bands initially, although they were quickly pegged that Brits pretty quickly figured out these guys wanted to go to America, and they had some pretty ugly backlash. We talked about it on the Metal Evolution series when they returned to England after their first American tour and played a big festival. I mean, people were throwing bottles filled with urine at them and stuff. They were just pegged as sellouts, but nonetheless, they were part of Nawabum, the poppiest end of it. And I think the punk, what Lang saw as punk was the energy. And also what he said was, you're not going to have pretty background vocals like you have on Journey, you know, or Kansas. You're going to have shouted backing vocals. And when you listen, it's really a mix. There's definitely some shouted background vocals, but also plenty of pretty background vocals. But I could kind of see what he meant by punk. But then again, it's hard to see exactly what he meant by punk. But now let's talk about Bon Jovi, because Bon Jovi comes in. And, you know, he was a Springsteen fan from Jersey. His cousin, Tony Bon Jovi, was a producer for the Ramones, of all people, and also the Talking Heads. He owned the Power Station studio, of which the band Power Station was named for. And John Bon Jovi couldn't get anybody interested in his demo. He had a demo of a song called Runaway. But he got the demo out, and he got radio play in the New York City area. And as I learned in my Joan Jett episode, Long Island actually had some pretty open radio stations. If you're a regional band in that area at the time, like Joan Jett, you could get your independent record played on some of the biggest radio stations on the East Coast. And so Bon Jovi was able to do that. And so PolyGram signs him. But the thing about Bon Jovi and metal is, he didn't see himself as a metal artist. He you know, records his first album, and his plan was to tour with The Cars and Bryan Adams. But his management pushed him to open for The Scorpions and Kiss. And I have to say, it was a very smart move, because the guy said at the time, we want that loyal metal audience. We don't want a pop audience. And it was this sort of heartland metal audience was out there at this time. You know, this massive middle American audience that had been raised on Montrose and Nugent and Kiss and AC/DC and all these, you know, 70s hard rock bands. And they were an immensely loyal audience that you had to break basically through touring. It was the only way to reach that audience. So it was this immensely loyal thing. And I kind of view the whole 80s metal thing as a cashing in on the credit that was built up with the grassroots by hard rock bands in the 70s. Because definitely the audience that's going to, this kind of metal is going to evolve into things like Poison and Warrant and Winger, et cetera, that had anything but this loyal heartland audience. It morphed into pop, and then it got a pop audience, and it lost that loyalty. But for Jovi in the 80s, this was a move. But what was your take on Jovi, and where did you see him in the whole?
Well, you know, it keeps reminding me, and it does again tonight. It reminds me of what you said about the Police a couple times now, that they and I totally bought what the Police were selling, because they looked like punks. But as you pointed out, they were really a prog band, and
a damn fine one. But
yes,
with great pop songs.
Yes, but you know, because of the way they looked, and they had the, you know, they were on IRS. No, they weren't on IRS, but their manager was IRS records president. But and they had a connection to REM, but same with Bon Jovi. It's almost like it was a packaging deal. They had the hair, and so, okay, let's stick them in hair metal instead of more of a pop realm. And you know,
and
I can
not even
I see it
pop, but more sort of new. I mean, the Cars were definitely new wave. They were one of the yes. definitive new wave bands. But Bryan Adams was one of those weird sort of heartland rockers like Tom Petty or yes. John Cougar Mellencamp, the children of Bruce Springsteen. And so that would have been a pretty comfortable niche for Bon Jovi. But those guys didn't have much cool cachet. They had short hair. People liked them, but nobody was getting John Cougar Mellencamp tattoos. And if you've got one, I'm sorry, I missed you. But any listener out there that's got a John Cougar Mellencamp tattoo. But I just didn't know those people. And so I think Jovi's team, Don McGee is the manager that Matos mentions. And it was a very, very smart play. And it was a time when you could adopt a few tropes, like really long hair and hats and leather, black hats and leather, you know, the look that Richie Sambora and John Bon Jovi had. And there was a huge audience of people who were willing to believe, okay, that's a heavy metal band to me, you know. Yeah. And it worked incredibly. Let's take the sponsor break. When we come back, we'll talk about the underbelly of heavy metal in 1984. We're talking about Judas Priest, Motorhead, and Iron Maiden.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So yeah, so we've talked about the LA strip scene with Van Halen and Randy Rhoads. We've talked about Bon Jovi coming from the East Coast as kind of faux metal or pop metal. And he's later going to give Desmond Child, who I've discussed many times on the show, plenty of paydays. That's the guy who wrote Kiss's disco song, wrote Aerosmith's, co-wrote Aerosmith's Dude Looks Like a Lady and other comeback hits. And you know, when Alice Cooper wanted to come back and wanted a hit single in the 80s, he called Desmond Child. And so, you know, Jovi did a lot of work with Desmond Child. But meanwhile, while this faux metal stuff is going on, there are bands like Judas Priest who have defined a new kind of metal. It's black leather. It's not denim. It's fast, where Sabbath had been sludgy and slow. It's fast and cutting. They've upped the classical influences. Rob Halford is swiping Freddie Mercury's I'm an Opera Singer bit, and again, increasing the classical music influence, which to me is what separates metal from hard rock. If it's got a bunch of classical influence, it's metal. If it's more blues based without the classical influence, then it's hard rock. But Priest is essentially inventing what we think of as heavy metal now, but at the time was seen as really extreme heavy metal. And you know, Motorhead was another one of the leaders of the new album. I mean, you can argue about whether they were precursors of new album or whatever, but they're definitely. Motorhead was the English band that most successfully combined punk and metal and appealed to both those crowds. They were initially hated by critics, but by 1984 had become critical darlings, mostly because of their failure to become a huge band in America, I think. And meanwhile, you also had Iron Maiden, who were, along with Def Leppard, the champions of new album, but they were the heirs of Judas Priest, where Def Leppard self-consciously went in a glam pop direction. Iron Maiden was all about heavy and prog, and their initial singer had copped a punk look. He was a punk, basically. Their first singer was a punk guy. He had short hair. He was more of a shouter than a singer. But when they brought in Bruce Dickinson on the third album with the operatic vocals, they were a full-on metal band, and were codifying this new underground metal. I mean, metal was so big in my high school. Like, all the popular girls and popular guys liked The Crew and Van Halen and Jovi. And then the stoners out back smoking in the school smoking lot, which we had, they were listening to Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. You didn't hear a lot of Motorhead back there, but you definitely heard the Priest and Maiden and a little bit of Motley Crue and definitely some Ozzy, but not a lot of Bon Jovi back there. So what was your take on this nascent leather metal? Let's call it leather metal.
Well, I think the distinction you make, I actually was thinking of it as the European, this Germanic European feel. And again,
definitely Judas a factor, and the Scorpions should be mentioned in that, but go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Judas Priest and the Scorpions were on MTV when I was first introduced to it all the time. And especially Judas Priest, just like Come On, Feel the Noise. It feels like an archetype. It feels like to me, that was heavy metal defined. And I was a practitioner, and I was also a consumer of hard rock. And a lot of this stuff, because of where I lived, because of the smaller towns where I lived, I was hearing zero hard rock. And so this all was kind of blossoming and branching off. And I think you can make a really good distinction about I just think it was really a powerful image for Judas Priest, and also just the sound was so distinctive, and it just had such a mood. When I first saw that video, and I think that's the one where the guitar player is wagging his tongue at one point, and me and my sports writing buddies are all watching it and just laughing, but it also was really such an image that stayed.
It crystallized avatar of what heavy metal was. And then Iron Maiden built on that. Iron Maiden also had the Eddie icon, which was on all their album covers, which you know, sort of desiccated living skeleton with long corpse hair on its head. A great character icon. And then they were able to use it on stage in giant form and stuff. And they were able to keep the band kind of faceless that way. Iron Maiden, even though Bruce Dickinson's a great frontman, but he's not Rob Halford. He's not David Lee Roth. He's not quite on that level. And so, and they were able to, you know, replace the first singer, Eddie DiCarico, and not miss a beat, only get bigger and bigger in America. And meanwhile, Matos talks about what these guys are brewing in the underground, which is a young band called Metallica. They talk about Lars Ulrich, the drummer of Metallica and co-founder, who had come from Denmark. But he was way into the new wave of British heavy metal, and he was into Saxon and, you know, Diamond Head and more of the hardcore end of that stuff, Praying Mantis. And, you know, there was a flood of great new album bands that I'm only beginning to go back and discover. But meets a guy, you know, puts together Metallica with James Hetfield. They find Dave Mustaine, who's originally the lead guitarist and co-writes much of their first album, but is fired before their first album and replaced and goes on to form Megadeth. But by 1984, Metallica had already signed with Elektra. They'd already put out Master of Puppets, and no radio play, no MTV, and yet they're beginning to sell serious units because of this nascent metal underground. I mean, every white kid in America, it seemed like, pretty much was a metalhead. And not that there weren't plenty of non-white kids that dug metal as well, but this was just the ubiquity of metal in this period is really hard for people to understand. This is before hip hop breaks into the American heartland with you know, white audiences. That's not going to happen until NWA comes along in the late 80s. So if you wanted heavy, hard rock and stuff, these bands pretty much had the feel to themselves. And, you know, so he gets Metallica in there. And then he talks about Dio a little bit, Ronnie James Dio, who had been the second singer for Black Sabbath. He had replaced Ozzy Osbourne. And before that, he was in Rainbow with Ritchie Blackmore, which was a big metal band in the 70s. Pretty much invented power metal, the whole operatic, you know, Dungeons and Dragons type lyrics and stuff. And, Dio probably was a Satanist, which is ironic. But he, you know, Matos tells the story of the Peters brothers of St. Paul, Minnesota, who built themselves a whole mini industry by pointing out the scurrilous and satanic things and heavy metal records. And, you know, Dio was right up there. But let's go ahead and hear our next song. Let's hear Def Leppard's Photograph. And when we come back, we'll talk about Twisted Sister and Motley Crue. And that was Def Leppard's Photograph, one of many hit singles off their 1983 Pyromania album, which was just absolutely massive. And Twisted Sister is pretty much analogous, I think, to an East Coast Quiet Riot. Like, they had been in the trenches for a long time. These are guys basically from Long Island who at some point saw the New York Dolls in Manhattan and decided, I want to do that too, and did it in Long Island for a decade. Nobody paid any attention except people in Long Island. And then they finally get a major label deal. Tom Werman comes on and produces their second album. And, you know, their massive hit, We're Not Gonna Take It. Again, you know, Dee Snider has this look that is almost drag. In the 70s, it would have been, you know, Twisted Sister would have been as edgy and hated as the New York Dolls had been. You know, the New York Dolls came out and really freaked people out with the androgyny in the early 70s. Twisted Sister, by the early 80s, this was mainstream stuff. And Dee Snider's look had only gotten more extreme. And musically, their playbook is based off ripping off Slade. Unlike Quiet Riot, they could actually write their own Slade-style anthems, but pretty much doing the same thing. So it's very interesting to me. I see a lot of the 80s glam rock as just 70s glam rock that is being reheated for Americans. Did you make that connection? Had you been aware of Slade? Did you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, Slade ended up having a couple of hits.
Yeah.
like late 84, early 85, it was almost like this brought them back. And I always, I even thought some of the guys in Guns N' Roses looked like old Slade were the guys that were wearing the platforms and just really tarted up, but very masculine. Unlike the Dolls. I totally agree though. It's almost like twice the makeup and the look for Crew and for Twisted Sister. It's like twice baked. It's not really new, and it really doesn't. It's kind of, I always, when I see Tommy Lee, I recently saw a picture of him back in the day, and you notice they didn't keep wearing that stuff. They didn't like Kiss, where they, you know, continued to wear it. But I guess D did for those 10 years.
Yeah, D. Snider definitely had a costume. It reminds me a lot of Boy George that we talked about last time. It was just part of these really over-the-top video characters. I mean, you could take D. Snider, Boy George, and Cyndi Lauper, who we'll be talking about in a few chapters, put them together. I mean, the three of them, you know, throw in Annie Lennox and a few other characters. I mean, there was definitely this sudden... It's like a whole bunch of cockatoos just exploded in the pop scene. And it's definitely got to do with MTV. I mean, you had the whole 70s period when bands like Supertramp, no idea what they looked like at the time. And then later you find out, wow, they look like a bunch of English guys who don't get any sun or wash their hair. You didn't have to be pretty to be in a band in the 70s. In the 80s, you definitely needed a look, or that gave you a competitive edge. And Motley Crue is definitely the band, I think, that most epitomizes this era, because they had seen what Van Halen had done. But they were really New York Dolls fans more so than they were, Ted Nugent fans or whatever. They were coming from kind of a punk place.
I agree. Yeah, you know, and they sounded more punk. They had a more punk sound, too.
Yeah, much more punk. Particularly their first album is very... new wavy sounding, sort of, or punk sounding. And yet they kind of updated the Kiss look but keeping it as their street clothes, as it were. Like, it wasn't like a costume they put on for the gigs. This is what they wore all the time. And, you know, Tom Zutat, who was a protege of Tom Warman, had discovered them at the Whiskey A Go Go. And, you know, Van Halen had revived the LA strip scene. And even though there was a long period of time when nobody in that scene could get signed, it kept building. And by the time the Crew comes along in the late 70s, early 80s, there's a lot of clubs to play. And you're right there in the home of the record industry. So, you know, they put out their album independently. It does very well. They get signed to Elektra. Elektra was very smart and savvy around this time. They're signed to Metallica, too. And, you know, it's just interesting to read some of the quotes that Matos gets, like... Tommy Lee is quoted saying, you know, one of the producers, I think Tom Warman was the producer, and he was very impressed when he, you know, gives his spiel, and Tommy Lee tells the band, if this guy's going to produce our album, we should listen to him.
Yeah.
And you don't think of Tommy Lee as the voice of reason, but there
that may be a bad sign. The moral center of Motley Crue, that's not a good sign, but go ahead.
Yes, and that's the other thing about Motley Crue. They were truly living their idea of the, quote, rock and roll lifestyle. And in a way, you have to respect that. In another sense, it's just a stupid, stupid thing to do. And it really killed all of them. But if you're going to be selling that myth to the kids, I think it probably is easier and more effective if you believe it yourself. And they definitely did. And they're Behind the Music documentary, for example, the VH1 documentary from the 90s, highly entertaining. And you come out, these guys are all, you know, mini Keith Richards's or Johnny Thunders's. Yeah. They live the lifestyle. Yeah. It's not like
they
Poison.
Walk the walk.
Yeah. Keep or talking. Somebody. Yeah. You know, the Poison Behind the Music is just this involuntary, you know, inadvertent comedy that is just, you know, I mean, it's true. It's really brutal. They made it at a time when Poison's commercial reputation was at its absolute bottom, and compare and contrast it with the Bon Jovi behind the music, which is this hagiography of what, you know, this second Springsteen or something, and Poison, they are just mercilessly savaging and mocking and you know, showing things like the guitar player playing different songs and the singer live on MTV, which killed him. But kind of on a sidetrack there, but the crew, I think, really epitomized this era. They at the now they're seen as hair metal and this kind of harmless, you know, thing. But at the time, they were seen as heavier than definitely than Bon Jovi, but also heavier than Quiet Riot or Twisted Sister. They had the black leather. They had the upside down pentagram. They had to change the cover of their second album to play down the pentagram. The original version was just a black upside down pentagram. You know, and they did enough of that so that, you know, the Stoners at my high school, the crew was number one. I mean, they were absolutely number one. And, you know, Judas Priest and Iron Maiden, they were beloved, but the crew there for a while was at the absolute top. And let's go ahead and hear a little bit of Motley Crue Shout at the Devil. And that was Shout at the Devil, the title track off Motley Crue's second album. Came out in 83, I think, and went big. Then their next album, Theater of Pain, and Matos doesn't talk about it, but they do a cover of Smoking in the Boys' Room by Brownsville Station and also some power ballads. And that broke them through to a mass pop audience, but pretty well killed them with the Stoners. It killed their hard rock credibility pretty dead. But did you catch the comparison to Porky's, to Bob Clark's infamous TNA flick Porky's in there in Matos's book?
Well, and I can totally see that because of how decadent they were and kind of still are. You know, Tommy, well, I mean, I became a Tommy Lee fan when he wrote his book and then had his very brief reality show when he went back to college. And I mean, the guy really does live it. And I mean, reading his book, you just realize how basically how he blew his marriage with Heather Locklear and what, you know, then what he did with Pamela. And I mean, it's all basically he videotaped it all. So, yep. I mean, and I saw them in 2000, by full disclosure, I think I saw them in 05, which was one of their first farewell tours or, you know, victory laps. And it was like at times a glorified strip joint. You know, which I had not seen a lot of. I mean, Van Halen was, I hate, it's kind of ridiculous to say this, but Van Halen's humor was a little more subtle. And, you know, I'm an old hard rocker. I mean, I keep thinking about Ted Nugent while we're talking about this. So if we ever do a group of podcasts about these podcasts, maybe we can do like a Ted, we can do an Uncle Ted Cheap Trick download.
Yeah.
He looms over this stuff so much. And I mean, he was so, he had such a great band and he had such a solid run in my, you know, in my era that he, you know, he belongs in here somewhere, but of course it was a different era.
Yeah. He's definitely definitive 70s hard rock. And the whole shirtless hairy dude thing was, David Lee Roth did a lot of that, but, and it's funny, like, you know, you look back at the Van Halen 1978, the Van Halen 1 album cover, he's wearing platform heels. I mean, his look is frankly like 5 years behind times for rock stars at that point. But by 84, he had updated his look and was just the definitive rock and roll frontman of that era.
Yes.
But there's a quote that Matos gets, which is a criticism. This is contemporary critics of Motley Crue. Saying, quote, "I'm struck far less by the implied Satanism," and it was hardly implied, it was explicit, but "than by the by a brutalized consciousness, romanticizing its own lack of hope. And he called heavy metal, quote, as reactionary a strand as popular music has ever produced. It's the spiritual godchild of the Reagan era, facing up to a complex world and responding with a long leap backward into machismo, sexism, militarism, and bigotry. So every bad thing is there. And I mean, it was a cynical worldview. The 80s was a cynical time. And it's interesting to me mostly how much the way that critics and people like me that were new wave, self-identified new wave or college rock fans or whatever at the time rejected heavy metal out of hand reminds me very much the way that Democratic voters like myself rejected Trump out of hand. I mean, it's the same rejection of what we see in the American heartland that we fear and hate. And the metal guys love it and projected that. And it's interesting to me, though, that punk was just as reactionary as metal. And I think it's borne out by the way the two merge in the hardcore scene. You know, Metallica was an outgrowth of the punk, of the hardcore punk scene as much as they were on the metal scene. And those scenes ultimately merge into one thing. And I think I've long thought that punk and hardcore, if, you know, if John Belushi had lived and gotten to continue pushing, he had suddenly, you know, he'd become a hardcore punk convert late in life and late in his very short life. And I think if people, I don't know, it's just interesting. There's an alternative history where people like Jello Biafra are performing to hundreds of thousands of angry meatheads instead of, you know, a couple thousand or a few hundred. But instead, Motley Crue got that title, got the audience at the time. Did you see the stuff as reactionary and retrograde at the time, or did you see some of the innovative things that they were doing as well?
I would say, you know, that God, that's such a good question, because the way I was introduced to especially Metallica and also Guns N' Roses were from guys who were 10 years or 15 years younger than me, but guys that the guitar player I was in a band with taught guitar to, or a kid who worked kind of as our roadie. They were the ones who were telling us about this music. And then I'd turn it on and listen to it. It wasn't as melodic. You know, you're right about Motley Crue becoming more kind of more commercial later, but it was certainly more raw, and I wasn't used to it. I wouldn't hear anything raw on the mainstream, you know, album oriented rock radio. It's my own fault, but I didn't have a taste developed for it.
Yeah. And it was, I kind of developed an aversion to it. I mean, everybody I was around liked this stuff, but I kind of looked down on all my friends who liked Van Halen and Motley Crue the same way I looked down on them for watching Dukes of Hazzard every week.
Good.
And then they all thought I was a wuss because I listened to REM and you know, watched Carter Country or whatever. I don't know. but
that's a perfect example, though. That's that how those things go hand in hand. And there's, you know, kind of probably some pro wrestling in there too.
Yes, I did watch my share of pro wrestling, but I also looked down a little bit at my friends who took it too seriously. And you know, and later when I got to college and discovered that REM fans didn't like me any more than heavy metal fans did, and I definitely got much more sympathetic to heavy metal in college.
Yeah.
But well, that's pretty much it for our coverage of the Sunset Strip chapter of Motto. So next time we'll be going to the Shrine Auditorium for, I believe, the Grammy Awards. So this ought to be interesting. So I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, for Ed Legg, my co-host. We've been discussing Michelangelo Matos's brilliant Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year, and hope you'll come back next week and continue to follow our discussion of 1984. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you. Sounds fun.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate continues the Three Kings of American Pop series with the first part of his Frank Sinatra discussion with James Kaplan. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.